You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Hi listeners, this is Randy, the host of Dog Ear Radio Book Club. I just want to come on quickly before the start of this episode to let you know that this episode was recorded on October 17th. In this episode, we talk about the ongoing colonization and genocide happening to Palestinians right now in Gaza. So please be aware that any facts and figures and information that we provide are dated before October 17th, and much of this information has changed. Hello, listeners, and welcome to Dog-Eared Radio Book Club. I'm your host, Randy. Dog-Eared Radio Book Club is a bi-weekly book club on CITR 101.9 FM. And you can always reach me, the host. You can email me at dogearedbookclubradio@gmail.com. Or you can reach me on Instagram, which I recommend, at Dog-Eared Radio Book Club. So for today's episode, it is part two of my limited series on Babel by R.F. Kuang. So for this episode, I'm joined once again by Sunny and Malika. Hello, and how are you today? Sunny, let's start with you. How was your Tuesday?
Hello. Well, it's been a rainy day in Vancouver, so I went to work and stayed inside.
That's fair. It is the season. We even got rain in Alberta, which is impressive. Wow. It came with like 50 kilometer hour winds, so it was like super enjoyable.
Oh my gosh, the wind.
The wind is very real here. And how did today find you, Malika?
Today found me pretty good. I was actually pretty productive today. I actually got to writing, which I haven't done in a while. On top of just working, sold a few baked goods. We did a cupcake sale for in aid of Morocco and Libya for relief for the earthquakes. And that was fun. I haven't done a bake sale since like high school. It was weird going as a professional business though, because there's like an aura of like, you know, I'm not just a little kid doing it. I'm like,
yeah. So that sounds really cool. Yeah, I think I saw that on Instagram, but unfortunately I couldn't buy any because, you know, you can't ship cupcakes. But
I wish I could, because we had some really great
I wish you could too. I miss them so much. Okay, well, I want us to dive right into this episode because we had so much to say in the first part, and I know we're going to have just as much to say in this part. So for the listeners out there, as I mentioned, this is part two of our series on Babel. So in episode one, we broke down the plot of the book, the magic system in the book, and then we talked about a few questions on the theme of the book. So the first one that we covered is, where do you kind of see this novel in discussions of colonialism and its legacy? So in which we discuss the racism and colonialism of academia in Canada and across Western nations. The focus of this novel is on languages. So we discuss their use and translation as part of British colonization. So languages views very differently by characters throughout this book. So we discuss the question of how do you view one of the book's messages, quote, an act of translation is always an act of betrayal, end quote. Malika and Sunny shared great examples of how when translation occurs, specifically when languages are translated to English, something is always lost. So including a lot of cultural context and culture in general within the language. Lastly, we discussed the question that the author of the novel gave us, which is, quote, can powerful institutions be changed from within, or does revolution always require violence? For which we discussed how linked colonialism is to academia and how we cannot truly decolonize within colonial institutions. So in this episode, we're probably going to continue a lot of those threads of discussion that we brought up in that first part. And we're going to apply it more to diving into characters, specifically the four main characters of the book. So this would be Robin, Remy, Victoire, and Letty. And I also want, if we have time at the end, to get into kind of the social media and cultural impact around this novel. Obviously, when this novel came out, because R. F. Kuang was already known for the Poppy Wars, it had quite a lot of recognition behind it. And it's quite popular on social media spaces such as Bookstagram and BookTok. But based on our last episode, like I said, we're going to have a whole lot to say. So please stick around for the whole time. So I want to dive in right away to some discussion on the characters. So the first question that I have is kind of specifically about Robin, the main character that we follow for the majority of the novel. So in the last episode, we brought up the idea that the characters in this novel are chess pieces for the plot of the novel. So I want to speak about the role and position of, you know, what these characters represent and, like, you know, their importance to, you know, like, or like how they're structured, I guess, like why they're written the way that they are to be the specific chess pieces that they are. So I want to start off with Robin, who goes on a journey of working through his own understanding of his position at Babel, of being of mixed Chinese descent and living in Oxford and working with Hermes and kind of finding his community and his family amongst Babel, but then also amongst this organization that is working against Babel. So why do you think Kuang decided to write Robin, the main character of this novel, and have him as the main voice of this novel? So I know that's kind of a big question, but I want to kick it off and start with Sunny.
I mean, I think how I would interpret it is just as an obvious writing choice for R.F. Kuang. She's Chinese, so it's certainly a lot easier to write a Chinese character. I know he's mixed race, but I think a lot of the story, the background, it has to do with his Chinese history, like especially when they start, when they go to Canton, which is like what that region of China, the southern region of China was called at the time, when they go there. And then, you know, there's like references to the Opium Wars that are about to happen. I think it's just a lot easier to write about when that's your history and you grew up learning about it.
I think that definitely rings true, and that's kind of how I thought about it as well, because it seemed like it was a good way to explore that, like, history that she wanted to, which I think she did. Like, she wanted to explore the history of colonization kind of more specifically through those events that you're talking about, like when they go to Canton, when they go to China, and they're talking about opium and the British. Malika, do you have anything to add to that?
No, I was just gonna say, I think it's like the perfect main character to use as a vehicle for the story, because Kuang, I'm pretty sure, I think she's getting her PhD like within this, the realm of the topic of Babel. Sorry, I always forget how to say it. So no, I agree with both of you guys. I think that, like, as a writer too, coming from a place of comfortability where you write, it just makes dealing with complex issues a little more easier. There's not less research, obviously. I'm not saying she probably researched the, like, crazy for this novel, but there's some sorts of, like, I don't know, just, yeah, that's what I have to say.
No, thank you. Yeah, I think it's an important conversation to have when we talk about, like, a book like this that does deal so deeply with topics of, like, colonization, history, racialization, things like that, that obviously the history and the race and the cultural background of the author plays a big role in how that book is written, which is, I think, kind of interesting in the context of, like, her writing Yellow Face, and, like, that's, like, a big, like, plot point of Yellow Face, right? But that's not what we're talking about in this episode. Okay, so my next question that I want to talk about is it's kind of a complicated question, and I'm going to fully say that I don't know how well I wrote it to like explain kind of what my brain was thinking. But the gist of it is that race is obviously a major role in this novel. When you write a book about colonization, you're talking about the way in which the oppressor acts towards the oppressed. But it also discusses, I think, a lot in this book. We get instances of racism towards the characters. We have racism in academia through Babel, the professors, how they act, how they behave, and then more generally in Oxford. So Rami is an Indian man who is described as, quote, immediately visibly other. And Victoire is a Black woman. So I'm contrasting these for the context of the question, but I'm not doing it in a way to like separate them. But in contrast to Robin, who in one part of the book is described as being, quote, was foreign only when viewed up close. So kind of gives this recognition of like being able to, you know, when we talk about the history of race and like the history of passing to a very, very limited extent. And then at the very end, we have Letty, who is a white woman from a British military descent, quite like very wealthy British family. So what connections, if any, do you draw from these characters' experiences in the novel with our like contemporary conversations that we have a lot about racism in academia? But then also I wanted to touch on that aspect of like light skin privilege and colorism. That's the word I actually wanted to think of. I want to turn it over to Malika to kick us off, if you want, with your kind of thoughts around this.
No, it's just something so prevalent in our society because colorism affects every inch of the world. Like whether you're Canada, India, like no matter what, every culture has it so steeped into their rooted beliefs. Like earlier this year, it's kind of off topic, but not really. There was a movie that came out, a Bollywood movie, big, huge production. It was like one of the biggest of the year. And there was a line in the thing where he was like, oh, no, I don't take my tea dark or something. It was something about tea. It will make my skin like my skin won't go light. It will go dark. And the family just goes into him being like, oh my gosh, you're so racist. I can't believe we have a colorist in the house, blah, blah, blah. And he was like, no, I get it. Hashtag Black Lives Matter. Like he just went on, like he was like, I just don't understand what's wrong with that. Like, so, and then it was like all about him learning and stuff. So it's like, even in this modern day, like he was fully in the social media culture, in the woke culture, in like the culture of like, we're in this era of cancel culture versus accountability culture. Like there's so many of these internet discourses going on, where it's like people aren't understanding the true gist of colorism and the fact that it's rooted in white supremacy and colonialism. White people came and adhered their beauty standards, their way of living onto colored populations. We see it in, and that's what, I don't know if it was the Poppy War. I think it was the Poppy War in Kwong's writing where, oh my gosh, I'm forgetting the main character's name of the Poppy War, but she is a darker skinned Chinese woman Chinese woman. And they just discuss like how like different she is treated within her school. And it's like within every culture, there's just this, we've been touched by this colonial colorist notion, like things you don't even realize. Like it's always like things that you're told as a kid, like it's like, oh, don't play out in the sun too much. Make sure you wear a hat. Like you don't want to get too dark. And it's like, oh, like you're thinking, like I was thinking, oh, skin cancer, very bad. But like, that's not what everyone else is thinking. So I think in academic discussions as well, like we neglect colorism just for the fact that like people don't see it as a real issue. It's like, oh, like there's a big debate going like, oh, light skins are just as like light skinned people, light skinned colored people are just as oppressed as dark skin thing. But it's like it lacks nuance and intersectionality in that statement where it's like, yes, you are a colored person, you are an oppressed person. But it's like, what privilege do you seek or what privilege do you gain from not being, like, it's your proximity to whiteness that gives you privilege. So that's just what I would have to say about academic debates on it, because people like to say it's like not a thing.
Yeah, I can definitely see that. I'm trying to think, like, even we didn't discuss it, I would say, enough in our Like the class that we take, I think it's GRSJ 315, and it's like about the construction of race. I don't really remember that much because it is, I think it's a contentious topic, not in like the way that I'm like, oh, it's like too complex. That's not what it, like, I mean, like it, I think it literally just is because it's so rooted in white supremacy, it becomes very difficult. But I always think about representation in media. And I even think about, I think we had a conversation when the second season of Bridgerton came out. And there was like a lot of dialogue online about the casting of, I can't even think of their names. The sisters in it, or yeah.
Yeah, no, I remember that because there was a lot of discourse being like, oh, why'd they have to choose darker skin actresses? Why'd they have to do this? Blah, blah, blah. And it's like India, like I'm speaking for just like in this, the Indian culture, like we're not monolith in our color. People have this perception of what they see in media as being like the just color of India. And like it varies from region. Like in American television, I've noticed it's a lot of like if they're trying to portray like a nerdier or like those stereotypical like Indian like people, like they're usually darker, a little bit more like they want to like they're trying to portray them as nerds and tech bros and people with like crazy brains, but at the same time dumb them down based on like, oh, they're just like village idiots sort of things. Like, so it's like that dichotomy even there, it's like how does that even work? And it's like a lot of those stereotypes are attributed to darker skin. It's like and in Indian cinema it's the same way, or like just in Indian like life in general, it's like, oh, you know, you're more richer, you're more like wealthier, successful if you have lighter skin because you're not working outside. Like those are things like you hear growing up. It's like, oh, you know, they must be poor and working outside, that's why they're a bit darker and stuff. So it's just like it's such a, I think the reason why academia hasn't even begun to tackle the issue of colorism is because it's not seen as an issue. They don't see the like long-lasting psychological effects it has on kids, women, men even. Like, why is it like skin lightening creams are still like one of the most bought products of South Asian people? Like even my grandma and my mom, I'm pretty sure, still use it. And then I tell them, oh, it's not wrong, like it's pretty wrong to use it, and they're like, oh no, it's just like a little bit of darkness here and there, like we just need to get rid of. And it's like, oh my goodness, like we're feeding into bad narratives, we're feeding into what the colonial projects want.
Yeah, I agree with everything that you said, Malika, and I think that academia has so much to do to catch up, to be able to have conversations and lead conversations on this. I want to turn it over now to Sunny, if you have any thoughts to share.
Yeah, for sure. I want to come at this kind of from a Vancouver angle, so this might be a little bit specific, mostly just because I haven't really existed as an adult in other parts of the world. But Robin's experience, I feel in contrast to Rami and Victoire's experience, feels a lot like how people exist in Vancouver to me. And what I mean is by, I'm Chinese, I am a bit of a dark-skinned Chinese, kind of like Rin from Poppy War, but in Vancouver as a setting, I feel like I'm not seen as a threat anywhere I go. So there's a certain proximity to whiteness that I feel like I have by being a lighter skinned BIPOC person, and also being like, I'm not mixed race like Robin. I think people have mentioned who are mixed race that they didn't feel like Robin was always representative of them, since Kuang is also fully Chinese. But I kind of associate his experience to kind of being like Asian Canadian, where you grew up here and you have that sort of language to exist in white spaces, as opposed to someone who had come here from China. And I feel like as myself, like it's very easy for me to navigate a lot of spaces. Like obviously I experience racism, but I'm never seen as a threat. Whereas, you know, my friends who are Black and darker skin can't say the same. Like if they're walking out at night, sometimes, you know, you get these white people who think they're scary for no other reason than their skin color. And I feel that kind of exists in academia as well. Like some of the local schools have gotten in trouble for being terribly racist towards Black people, even though our Black population is so small. So I feel like you've got to try really hard to be racist. And, you know, it comes naturally to some of these academic institutions. And when you look at upper administration in academia in today, too, you have, you know, mostly white male professors and faculty members, but you also have a lot of, you know, there's a growing number of white female profs as well, because white women benefit the most from these EDI initiatives. But then after that, you see a lot of East Asian men. Like, it just is common to see a lot of racialized minorities who are lighter skinned. And I agree with Malika, like, academia doesn't really address that fact. They're like, oh, we have more racialized profs, but like, what are the numbers? Like, what is the breakdown of these faculty members? And I think, you know, Babel really captures that in a modern sense of the world. I obviously don't know what it was like in 1800 in this fictional universe, but I'm assuming, you know, there's a lot of similarities to what is happening in the real world right now in academia.
Yeah, the one note that I had is that, like, how universities need and desire BIPOC students. They feature them in advertisements, they boast about them, like how many diverse students, how many international students they admit. And I think that is similar for, like, higher up positions. Like, I know UBC absolutely loved to talk about their president, who I'm literally blanking on his name, which is wild. Can any of you remember it?
Is it Santa Ono or the new one?
Yeah, well, I think it's a new one now, but yeah, Santa Ono was the old president. Yeah, but I think he went down to the States. But yeah, like, they love to, like, talk about that and, like, push that as their narrative, that, like, we're such a diverse. But then, as we talked about in our first episode, like, part one, universities do nothing to protect BIPOC students, and especially international students. Like, they don't do anything to protect students that face hate crimes on campus. They don't do anything to protect them in classrooms when they're, like, they have to defend their own humanity and existence inside, like, a quote-unquote academic context to all these, you know, terrible people that are like, well, I just want to play devil's advocate for a second here. Yeah, Malika, do you have some thoughts you want to add?
Yeah, no, I just want to add, poli-sci classes were the worst for that, because it was like, oh, we have to be objective. And it's like, no, you're just straight up being racist. Like, there's no objectivity when there's something that's inherently racist. Sorry, I just really didn't. I was thinking for a hot moment, I wanted to be a poli-sci minor. Did not last one class.
Yeah, that was me with history.
A lot of degrees are like that. I looked into Asian studies, saw who the profs were, and were like, absolutely not. But kind of to continue on that thought, like, they don't protect students, because if you dig into the staffing in the faculty level, like, the problems start so high up, and you look at the leadership, that it's I don't know what it's called. There's like a triangle where it's like the leadership up top were all white, and then you get, like, at the bottom are the people of color. But I also think there's like a colorism kind of scale to it, because I work at the university right now, and I see a lot of East Asians like myself working there. And I feel like we experience a lot of things due to higher ups who are white. But, you know, there's also a lot of East Asians we can complain to each other. And you just don't see a lot of people who are darker skin toned. And then the other thing is, like, you just, there's that sort of the international students, like you say, like, there's that sort of distinction among higher ups too, where if you have good English, you grew up here, then you are able to climb up higher than if English was not your first language. You see that a lot in the staffing level as well. But that's something that students don't, like, there's no stats, like, you can't really find proof of this. And I think there's just so many layers to it, and it really sucks because students are at the bottom of that totem pole. Like, there's this whole mess up in the bureaucracy that the students are up against, and it really sucks.
Yeah, and it leaves, I think it, I don't know, you feel quite powerless as a student at a university. I actually saw a TikTok talking about like student organizing at university, that like universities benefit so much from students only being there for 4 to 5 years, because if every 4 to 5 years you're cycling a new batch of people to organize, like, not that movements can't gain ground, I'm not saying that, but it makes it so much harder, because it's like you have to like retrain and reorganize every single year, essentially. So it really prohibits or holds back, I think, students from like being able to truly show their voice and show like their anger, I guess would be the word, to administration.
Universities of accountability as well, because tenured mm-hmm. profs are so protected.
Yeah.
And, you know, students, they're here for a semester before they don't take the class anymore, so they're able to just kind of put it aside.
Yeah. Yeah. I also, like, when you're talking about the, like, hierarchy, like, a pyramid shape, I think that's so true. If you, like, look, even in the GRSJ department, like, the amount of profs that are, first of all, in general across GRSJ, that are BIPOC professors tend to be like associate professors. Assistant. I don't even know whichever one's lower. I always forget, but like they always tend to be at like the bottom. They're getting paid the least. And then you'll go to like the science department or like the history department, and there'll be like all these tenured profs that are like old white dudes, and you're like, something about this smells extremely fishy.
Yeah, I actually didn't ever put that together. I was just like, oh yeah, GRSJ probably is just mostly associate or assistant profs, like, but you putting that into perspective, it's like, that's quite messed up. Like, I'm not gonna lie, I knew right from high school what I wanted to do. I wanted to major in GRSJ, so that's the only department website I really looked at. So wouldn't even bother going into the other ones. But that's just so, obviously there's unfairness to it, and I'm just can't be like, oh, it's so unfair, but like, that is what it is.
Yeah, there's definitely, I think, like what you're saying, Sunny, that like, it just, universities are so slippery, like they're doing everything they can to have their PR image be so much better than what they're actually doing. Anyways, we're going to take a very quick break. And when we get back, we'll maybe continue this conversation. Or most likely we'll move into some more discussion about some characters. So don't go anywhere, listeners.
Tune in every Thursday from 11 p.m. till midnight for Copy and Paste with your host, Tim, a.k.a. Autonomy, the very best in underground dance music.
Everyone at VAMS understands the challenges of having a disability in an able-bodied world. Since 1988, the Vancouver Adapted Music Society has supported musicians with disabilities on their journeys. Check out Reimagine Radio on YouTube to learn more about our diverse community. To stay up to date with us, subscribe to the channel and drop a like to show some support.
Do you love being caffeinated? And do you hate that greedy, soulless international conglomerates are succeeding in the cutthroat world of coffee? Sounds like local coffee roasters Trek Coffee is for you. Trek Coffee is 100% indigenous and military veteran owned and operated. Let's keep small businesses thriving. Stop by Sunshine Convenience on 4th, the Super Value on Commercial, or Grocery Checkout in the Nest to pick up some Trek coffee today.
All right, listeners, welcome back to Dog Abe Radio Book Club. I'm your host, Randy. Today I am joined by Malika and Sunny, and this is part 2 to our series on Babel by R.F. Kuang. And in this episode, and before the break, we're talking about the characters in the book, but we're really diving into conversations about colorism, racism, academia, and different things that we see specifically with Vancouver and UBC. So I do kind of want to move on to our next topic just because I know that there'll be a lot to talk about. Or maybe it's just me that I have a lot to talk about. I don't know. Maybe I'm biased. But I want to talk about Letty because I am absolutely fascinated in like the most disgusted way with this character, in like a good bad way. I don't know the right word. If anyone has a word that means all of those things, let me know. But I want to talk about Letty and white feminism. Huge shout out to R.F. Kuang for this like absolutely excellent, stellar depiction of white feminism that so perfectly reflects what we see in contemporary political circles and feminism in media. From Letty weaponizing her tears to gain sympathy from her, quote, friends, to being completely oblivious to the discrimination that Victoire experiences. She's ticking every checkmark of the classic white feminist. So my first question is fully rooted in the context of the novel. So if you have not read the novel, you probably won't get this, but also this is a spoiler to the novel. So just as a heads up for anyone. So my first question is, did you see Letty's betrayal coming? Did you see it? Did you see her murdering Rami and betraying them? Okay, go ahead, Malika.
There's two monsters inside of me, being one being like, oh, she's 100% going to betray them, and one being like, oh, let her be one of the good ones. Because, like, let me be honest, I have been fully, like, immersed in the propaganda of there being, like, oh, there's always, like, you know, white people, white feminists that will be on your side. Like, one of my favorite movies when I was younger, like, there was fully, like, it was about Indian colonization in the Sepoy War. I don't even know why this was a favorite as a child, guys. It was a boring movie, but I was a weirdo. And there was a white character, and he ends up, like, saving, like, he's a weird character because he, like, ends up betraying the British and joining the side of the Sepoys against the colonial powers in that sector of India. And so I was kind of hoping for Letty to be that sort of character. But then you see her kind of like not understanding, and those like little seeds of things you see in real life of like white feminists where it's like, oh, but it couldn't be that bad. Oh, it's not like that. Like you see it really relevant in today's time with what's going on in Palestine, with how white feminists are like, they're kind of just re-perpetuating very bad stereotypes about Muslim men, Arab men, of this hypersexual sense, like, oh, they're going to come in and, like, sorry, this is very triggering words, so content warning for everything I'm about to say here, but, like, they'll say things like, oh, they'll come in and rape us all, oh, that's when they come to America, and then they'll enact that type of hypersexualized violence on us, like, all these, this discourse is coming out around it, and it just feels like, come on, this is like a rinse rewash cycle of what happened during 9/11 and what's happened when they invaded Afghanistan and the rhetoric that came out around then. Sikh men were starting to be affected by then their visible turbans. And it just really shows you who your ally is, because like everyone was cutting their hair for Iran when the whole uprisings and stuff were happening there. And honestly, show your support for revolution. That is great. But then when it's coming to a topic like Palestine, you see many more Lettys who will shoot Ramis to uphold the colonial empire of the settler project.
Yeah, I was telling my dad today that social media around Palestine right now has really proved to me, and I think to everyone, how conditional the allyship of white people is. And I think Letty exemplifies this. Like when it benefits her, she stands with them, and as soon as it doesn't benefit her anymore, she betrays them. And I just, yeah, it's so accurate to exactly what we're seeing right now in the way that white people are incapable, and especially queer white people. Like, I'm sure we've all seen the pinkwashing that's going on, the accusations that you don't deserve humanity because there's homophobia in a country, which I don't know if you've ever been to Canada, but yeah. Anyways, Malika, you look like you have another thought.
Yeah, no, I have so many thoughts on this, but it was just interesting. Like, I had another thought before, but you brought up pinkwashing, and I've just been so passionate about that. Because I don't know if you guys have heard about this website, Queering the Map. I've just heard about it very recently during this time, actually. And you're seeing all these, like, queer couples and stuff posting their tragedy in this area, in the occupied territories. And it's like, oh, I should have been brave and told the world. And it's like this guilt that they have for feeling like they look torn. Like there was this one person who was talking about, I feel like I couldn't come out, obviously, and being like, I'm Palestinian when I'm fighting with my writer, like fighting alongside my brothers and sisters. But they at the same time say I'm American, I'm white and stuff because I have these feelings. And it's like people don't see that there are queer people in Palestine. Like there's so many of them. So many of them are watching their loved ones, their queer loves die in front of them, and they can't even express it the way. Like I'm not saying obviously it's horrible when a man and a woman or like anyone that is straight presenting, like when they're partner dies in that tragic sense, but not even being able to show that fact, and yet we're saying, oh, but one state allows us to be, and that's not even true. Israel, it's quite illegal to be gay, and they do, there's hate crimes galore there. Like it's not just, oh, and it goes back into the rhetoric against Muslims and Arab people where it's like, oh, they're savages, they're brutes, they'll kill you if you show anything that isn't the dominant culture that they have.
Yeah, it's definitely I think that's why it's literally called pinkwashing. Like you're washing away all of the, yeah, you're just painting it so beautifully for like the eyes of anywhere else, and then you're critiquing only this one area. Sunny, I want to open up to, do you have any thoughts you would like to share?
Sure. I'm just going back to your question, and I think I always read books very optimistically, so in some sense I was hoping that Letty wouldn't go that far, but it's also because I liked Rami, so you know, I didn't want anything to happen. But I also feel like because she represents white feminism as an ideology, I don't think she represents any individual white person. It's like the ideology that she represents. I think that like optimism that I had for her is kind of how you would approach people who identify as white feminists, because they really do support you. They genuinely do, while it's convenient. And I think they delude themselves into thinking that they're really supportive of your cause. But then when something makes them uncomfortable, and in their case, the thing that threw her off is when they finally murder Robin's father, Dr. Lavelle. I have thoughts on him, by the way. I know you didn't have questions about Dr. Lavelle, but I have thoughts on him. But when they murder him, she's like, oh, this has gone too far. And I think that's where she starts to fully crack. Like you saw like little cracks before, but I think that's where it fully cracks. And I think that's what people are, like Malika's mentioning now, like that's what you see with these comments on Palestine, like online, that you just see, like these are the same people who are really supportive of all these different causes like BLM. And suddenly you see these cracks because Palestine's too much for them. Throw it back to Malika now. I know you have lots of thoughts.
Yeah, no, I was just gonna say, for Letty as this embodiment of the ideology of white feminism, it was so interesting to me that like she had so much care and empathy for when Dr. Lavelle, who was quite honestly like a horrible, horrible person, like he, oh my gosh, what he did to like Robin's mother, what he did to Robin and Griffin, like how can you justify that man? Like he is evil. Like if we're talking about how these people are chess pieces, Dr. Lavelle was probably evil incarnate to me. Like I just, nothing could justify his actions, nothing at all. But Letty had so much compassion and empathy for his death, where it started the cracks of her, where she saw Rami, because, and there's Rami, we can go into so much about her relationship with him. Like it can go into this thing where it's like, did she feel like Rami owed her a relationship because he was nice to him, going into this whole fetishization of the Oriental being, like, because that was how they would talk back then, and it's like the exotic mystification of the Orient, and like that in itself was crazy. And then obviously Rami didn't reciprocate those feelings, and then it's not, killing's not bad when you're killing a brown man who doesn't accept your feeling, because she just shot him point blank. Like there was no thought about it, and she didn't really feel that much guilt. But when these people, like Robin has every right to kill his father, like that, spoiler alert, I don't know if we said that, Dr. Professor Lavelle.
I did not, because I actually had to edit out my entire exploration of the plot in the last episode, because I was like, why do you need to hear me talking? Our thoughts are so much better. So, but it's fine. I gave a spoiler warning earlier, so, and I don't even think that's like the biggest spoiler, you know, or maybe it is. I don't know. Whatever. Still read the book if you haven't read it. It's fine. Okay. Anyways, continue, Malika.
Yeah, but like he had every right to kill his father, and yet she couldn't find compassion for her friends who are dealing with this. Like, they're watching Dr. Lovell about to start a war in like Robin's homeland. Like, that is where he was raised, where the last memories of his mother are. But no, she has more compassion for him than a person who she has become friends with, because I think this is the fourth year of Oxford where all the like everything goes down. And it's like 4 years, that's a lot of time to build up a friendship or relationship just because he doesn't reciprocate your romantic feelings. Like, it was just so incredibly like juicy how she encapsulates the ideology of white feminism, because you see white feminists do that. It's like they'll fetishize the colored man, and then the second the colored man isn't this idea they had of what like he should be. Like, we see it in stereotypes about black men, we see it in stereotypes about East Asian men, and we saw it in her, how she believed Rami should be.
Yeah, well, and she does this thing that, like, in her chapter when we get the one, which that's a whole wild ride, reading that POV from her, especially after she's already shot Rami, you're just like, I want to throw this book out my window. But she does the thing that many white people do, where they justified colonialism and genocide against, you know, the homelands, the motherlands of the people that they quote unquote love, through separating them from the rest. And they're quote different. You're like the whole one of the good ones, things like that. And I think that goes in line with what you're saying, Malika, that like there's this fetishization. And then as soon as that's like not returned, all of that empathy is lost. It's just, it disappears. It's no longer available. I want to turn it over to you, to Sunny, for any thoughts that you have.
Just to continue on this idea of fetishization to killing Rami, I read this book called Racist Love, and it's really interesting the way it identifies fetishization, because what it says is that, I think Orientalism might have also mentioned this, but like fetishization is on the same side as like hate for a certain race, because both of them are dehumanizing. So in Letty's case, you know, and Brandy, what you mentioned about being one of the good ones is that if they label you as one of the good ones, they are assuming that you are a good person. So why do you have to be a good person if you're a person of color? And that putting you on a pedestal is exactly the same as dehumanizing you into not seeing you as a human, because in both cases, you're not seen as a human being. You have to be a good one. And suddenly when Rami's not one of the good ones anymore, then he goes from like her fetishized object to like her hated object. Human. She didn't see him as human. So there's a bit of, I think, the way she was attracted to him was the same way in which she hated him. I have to just make an insert about Professor Lovell. I am 100% convinced that he is named after Julia Lovell, which is a Chinese translator, a British Chinese translator, because that woman has a chokehold on Chinese translation. And why? Like, someone needs to explain to me why this white woman is the gatekeeper of Chinese translated literature. But don't quote me on that. I don't think R. Kuang ever confirmed that anywhere. But that's just my thought on it, because like her name is just such a big household name among like Chinese literature in the English speaking world that it's kind of hard to ignore why the professor was Professor Lovell.
Yeah, well, I believe you, and that makes perfect sense. And honestly, the amount of like, I don't know if you call them like Easter eggs or like just like incredibly clever writing and storytelling that Kuang puts in this novel, I would fully believe that. And I would also understand maybe why she wouldn't confirm that, but yeah.
Yeah, but translator's still alive today. There was actually a really huge controversy that happened at the British Museum recently. Julia Lovell was the lead translator of it, but they had accidentally, in quotation marks, stolen some other Chinese translator's work and didn't didn't credit them. So tells you all you need to know about the British Museum and these so-called Chinese institutions that are led by English people.
Yeah. Well, and there's so many, going back to like academia, there's so many Asian study departments that are headed up by white people, specifically white women. They have like a chokehold on schools in the U.S. in their Asian studies department. Yeah. And it's, yeah. I guess I should answer my own question. I realize I never did. I, very similar to both of you, I kind of read it as an optimist. You know, as a white person and who I consider to be like a ally that's always working and, you know, learning, I wanted, you know, to be like, yeah, to cheer on. But also simultaneously, it did not surprise me. Because I think what you said, Sunny, like as soon as Robin murders his father, she just, you could tell she took this turn. Like they described her as being very annoying. She would cry all the time and she would like, it was in a way that like stressed me out. She would do things that like had me stressed out because I would just be like, stop, please. And that was kind of like my clue that I was like, it's going to go down. But very similar to you, Sunny, also, I love Rami and I was so sad and I like it, that broke me. And I was like, okay, this book is not going to have any kind of happy little happily ever after ending. I don't want to say that it's not hopeful. I'm not saying that the ending isn't hopeful, but it's definitely not like a happily ever after. Yeah, which is not, which is okay. And it makes sense. Like I said, I think I said this in part one where it, like the ending to me made a lot of sense once I finished the book. I do just want to say like something else that I want to point out about Letty that she does in her epitome of white feminism and representing the archetype of white feminism is she strips Victoire of her womanhood. So in Letty's chapter, she talks a lot about how, you know, I'll just read the quote. So, quote, her friends were always going on about the discrimination they faced as foreigners, but why didn't anyone care that Oxford was equally cruel to women? End quote. And so, yeah, this literally just strips Victoire of her womanhood. And I thought about this because Victoire is a Black woman in the context of the Ain't I a Woman by, so is it Sojourner Truth? I should have looked up how to say this. I'm so sorry for mispronouncing that. But yeah, like basically how Victoire was put in this position where she defended Letty so many times to Robin and Rami when they like became frustrated with her and like were upset with her. And then none of that is turned around because Letty admits to herself at the end of her chapter that, quote, she has to at least save herself, end quote. So it just, it really points out that individualistic aspect of white feminism, that it's meant to be this like self-protecting and like self-asserting kind of like just protecting yourself at the end of the day.
Letty, even in that statement, it's just so interesting to see because she honestly truly believes that she is a good person. And that's like the biggest paradox of a white feminist. Like they truly, like, I don't fault them. They believe they're doing something great. They're like, oh yeah, we're going to get into the same level of CEO position and that's going to fix the world. Like, yay. Not realizing that it lacks intersectionality in its feminism. Like there are colored women who can't even make money to feed themselves, let alone become this adherence to the patriarchy. And that's what white feminism is. Like a lot, it's a really brutal truth that not a lot of people like to understand or accept. But when you're believing in white feminism, you're just believing in the patriarchy, but you just want to take those patriarchal roles yourself. Like, and you still want colored people to be suppressed. You still want people with intersectional marginalized identities to stay at the bottom of the hierarchy. Sorry, I forgot the word. So I just thought that was really interesting because it's like here Victoire is like, because, and that's what I love about all these characters. Like there was intersectionality in their oppressions and in their privileges too. Like Rami and Robin will never know what it's like for Letty and Victoire, but then at the same time, Letty will never, ever understand the pain and trauma that Victoire has had to go through her whole life. And but the thing is, Letty thinks it's the same. And it's just so juicy and just so complex, and like how Kwong dealt with all of those different types of intersectionality and marginalizations.
Yeah. And I also made a note about Professor Kraft at the very end. Is it Kraft? I think it, oh my gosh, I had it written down. Yeah, Kraft. Because she is a white woman, right? Am I correct in that? I was trying to double check that. And so she essentially joins, like when they overtake the Tower of Babel, she's there and she like stays. And I think it was really interesting to like go from Letty's betrayal, to then have Professor Croft taking kind of this like pretty active role in this, in like the revolution of Babel. And having her truly she sacrifices her life at the end to destroy the tower, I think draws this like, you know, lesson of like what is actual allyship, like what is true, like what does it truly mean to be like a feminist and an activist in these spaces. Yeah, so that was just like a note that I wrote, because of course my brain drawed kind of like similar, like, you know, the differences between like Letty and Professor Kraft. So we are getting like short on time, just to be aware. So I don't think we'll have too much time to dive into social media, which is fine. I'm completely fine with that. Because there is like so much to say. We've also said so much about social media already. But yeah, I just want to open it up to like any like other final thoughts that you want to share about the book. You know, if there's any other comments that you want to make, again, because like before we started recording, we did like touch on the fact that like this book is so incredibly relevant right now. And I just want to read this like fun little tweet that says, a lot of y'all didn't learn not a thing in your little 2020 anti-racist book clubs, and it shows. And I think about this as like, people who maybe read this book when it came out, and other people who read fantasy and sci-fi novels that deal with themes of colonialism are really showing their true understanding and their true humanity right now on social media. And it's not good. It's not looking good. So yeah, I'm gonna be quiet now, and I want to open it up to both of you. Maybe we'll start with Malika to kick us off and just kind of, yeah, give some final thoughts for us.
I just think it was super interesting, everything about social media and the relevance of this, because it's like right when Babel came out, like the reviews you would see online were generally positive. I'm not gonna lie, everyone loves the theory of colonialism and decolonizing, like everyone, and I've seen many social media posts on it where it's like everyone loves to sip tea and talk about decolonial theory and like be academic in their fancy little institutions, but when it comes to actually enacting decolonial thought and progress, that, and then everyone's a pacifist and it's like, we don't believe in violence, we don't believe in war, not realizing it's not a war, it's an occupation. So it's just, it's really wild how everyone can just ignore everything they've read. Like everyone during 2020, like with COVID, Black Lives Matter, everything was like, oh, we're the kids that grew up on Hunger Games, Divergent, like all these like very white feminist YA novels. Like, and don't get me wrong, I love both of them, but they're little white girls that are told that they can save the world, and it just lacks that nuance and representation, because like right when it's not someone you perceive to be as the hero, the leader of the decolonial or movement, or standing against a fascist occupation and all that stuff, then it's like not worthy. Like these little Palestinian kids are being bombed in hospitals, many war crimes are being committed, like phosphorus is being thrown at them, which is completely banned under the Geneva Convention, but that doesn't matter because these little kids are brown lives. And it's just interesting how social media and honestly the like main news sources and media, they have blood it's all blood libel they were spreading. They have full-on blood on their hands for how they weaponized just people's, it's the same fear-mongering that happened post 9/11, and it's coming back with a strong force. Like a little Palestinian Muslim boy was killed, a 6-year-old boy. like, was killed because of the radicalization within probably, what, 7 days? It's been, I don't think it's been very long since everything started unfolding and all the mass media standing with the Zionist occupation has been happening. And yet it was enough time to reach here and start people actually dying. Like, this little boy, apparently, like, I don't know how true or false this was. I just saw it quickly. And you know how headlines right now can be kind of dicey. But apparently the landlord that killed this little boy was friends with him. And, like, when he came in, the little boy went in for a hug. And that's how he ended up getting stabbed. Like, that shouldn't, like, so, and it's crazy how white allyship can even change like that. It's like, oh, yeah, I have, like, Muslim neighbors. I can't be racist. And it's like, the second you hear the fear-mongering of, oh, you know, it was the barbaric Islamists, it's the barbaric people who follow the religion, then it's like, oh, even these neighbors that I cared for, this little boy that I probably saw growing up, I'm going to murder him because that's what I'm being told is what's wrong with the world. So just social media discussion right now, and especially in relevance to Book Twitter's obsession with anti-colonial themes, it's just crazy, like, the hypocrisy. And that's what we can call it. It's just straight up hypocritical. Sunny, do you have anything to add? Because I can go on forever and I don't want to just.
No worries. I'm just thinking back to 2020 and, like, all of the ideas of BLM, decolonization. And I think what people actually really took from that, like, these, not just white people, but also other POC who haven't really thought about marginalization, because we know that POC can also ascribe to white feminism and a lot of, like, white ideology, white supremacist values. These books of 2020, I don't know if you felt the same, but a lot of them feel like they're marketable. Like, they wanted books on how to be a good person. They wanted books that made it easy for them to sympathize with a person of color. So a lot of books were like, you know, the traumatic immigrant story, but then, you know, once they come to America, things are better because, you know, these nice white people made their lives better. I don't know. They wanted, like, a marketable decolonization, but the roots of decolonization are not marketable. Like, it's not, it's about dismantling a system, and to dismantle an existing system that uses violence to oppress people, there's no other way to come out of that peacefully. Like, you have to retaliate in some sense. And I think back to, there's also this, like, short story book called The Secret Lives of Church Ladies. It's written by a Black woman. I cannot remember her name right now, but there was this one quote in there that I really stood out to me when I read it. And it's like, how can you be good? I'm paraphrasing, but it's like, how can you be a good person if you've never had the opportunity to be good? And that is kind of how I see people who are oppressed, like, example, like what's happening in Palestine right now. If you've been in an open air prison for so long, like, in what, like, there's no scenario to make you a good person, because I think the goodness that these white people are thinking of, especially, like, not just white people, but people of color who are privileged in North America, in these Western nations, we live in such comfort. It is so easy for me to, like, donate money, like, support a cause from the safety of my own home, I collect a good paycheck, like, it doesn't make me give up any of my privilege. And I think that's what makes it similar to, like, the 2020, like rise of BLM, and everyone's, like, co-opting it, because you can do it from the comfort of your own home without giving up your privilege. But to actually decolonize, you have to give up privilege, to give up your rights, and people are very uncomfortable with that. And so there's, like, that aspect of it where you see a lot of people rescinding, or people who are backing out of what, you know, you thought they were supporting you, but they're not. And then in terms of the violence, I just think, you know, people here, like us, like, we just live in such comfort that I think a lot of people don't understand what it's like to actually be oppressed in a violent scenario. Like, how are you supposed to fight back peacefully? There's no answer to that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think this novel perfectly reflects that. It shows us, this is a description of what decolonization looks like. It's not just like sitting in a classroom talking back and forth and then all going home to your safe, comfortable houses and, you know, returning the next day to do it all over again. So we are out of time. I want to thank both Malika, thank you so much, and Sunny, thank you so much for coming on the show and having this conversation with me. It was great.
Thank you for having me.
Talking.
Yeah. And I'm just going to end by saying Free Palestine, and I hope you have a good night.